So this is a special lecture because we're not going to be doing any physics, or so it seems, right? Because the math we're going to do today is going to be very useful. Remember, our final goal is to find something that really is a theory of quantum gravity that somehow is close to the standard model, and in order to get there, we will need the end product of what we're going to do today. So that's why we're going to do it. So we're going to discuss a little bit of complex manifolds. Now, why complex manifolds? Many of you might wonder, well, why are there complex numbers happening in the whole story? And if you are familiar with supersymmetry in four dimensions, you probably have seen that if you just consider just a tiny amount of supersymmetry, just n equals 1 supersymmetry, and even more so if you go to n equals 2 supersymmetry, you will find that somehow supersymmetry tames the path integral. The path integral looks like a crazy integral. And the more supersymmetry you put in, you can tame the object. And somehow the object starts to localize. And just like real integrals become very simple when you allow them to be complex, and you can do very crazy integrals using complex analysis, the same thing happens for the path integral. And sometimes you can do spectacular things in quantum field theories just by using complex analysis and complex manifolds. In fact, things that we're going to see today will also be useful in n equals 2 theories in four dimensions. Okay? So I'm going to assume that you know what a manifold is. Okay, so we're going to consider a manifold of dimension, and I'm going to put an R here just to remind myself that I'm talking about the standard dimension of this manifold, and it's going to be 2m. Okay, it's going to be only even dimensional manifolds that I'm going to consider today. Okay, so what are we going to do with our manifold? So our manifold, it's going to be this object. And of course, we're going to cover it with patches, OK? Say ui and uj, OK? And remember, in the standard case, what do? You find maps from here to where? You find maps from the patches to R2m, right? That's what you usually do. But that's not what we're going to do today. We're going to find maps that go to CM. You would say, well, what's the difference? Well, the difference is that I have endowed R2M with a complex structure. And in this case, all it means is that I have paired up the coordinates in a nice way, whatever way I like. And I have defined just n copies of the C-plane, just a Cartesian product of them. And I'm defining a map phi I from ui to here, okay, to some open set here. Okay, the same thing happens here. Okay, very good. Now remember, the standard thing that you do in the real case is to say, well, imagine that I consider the inverse map here, okay? And of course, if a point here coincides in the intersection of these two open sets, I can now consider the map that takes this point down here, okay? So if I consider the map phi I inverse phi j, this is a map that takes an element of what? Takes an element of phi I ui intersection uj. Remember, this is some piece here sitting somewhere here. This is the map of this intersection. And maps this to cm somewhere here. Okay? That map takes a point here, phi inverse here, okay, and sends it somewhere here. So the map, we can forget about the whole structure here and simply say that we go from here to here directly. Okay? So we now got ourselves, let's call it F, a map from CM to CM. Okay? Now the requirement that we want to impose is that F is a holomorphic map. Okay? What does it mean? Well, F is actually a set of objects, a set of maps, okay, that take a point here and sends it to something that we call the coordinate, the first complex coordinate of this guy, and so on. Now, we say that the map is holomorphic is if each of the components is holomorphic as a map from C, M, to C. Okay? Very good. Now, the collection of open sets with their corresponding maps to CM, if they satisfy all these properties, okay, so that at the intersections they behave nicely, meaning that the transition functions are holomorphic functions, then we say that this collection defines a complex manifold. Okay? And suppose that you have two collections. Suppose that, I don't know, one of you finds a collection and somebody else finds a collection. They don't have to be the same. You could ask, well, how do we know that they define the same object? Well, the way you know that is that imagine you define a collection of open sets and maps so that, or given by the intersection of the two. You can clearly do that, right? Sorry, by the union. It's not the intersection. It's by the union. You take your open sets together with your open sets, put them together, and with the transition functions, you can ask again the same question. Could this new set satisfy all these properties? Okay? Well, if the answer is yes, then we say that your maps, your collection here, and your collection define the same complex structure for that manifold. Okay? Is that clear? So the notion of complex structure is the following. You can have a real manifold, and different people can put different complex structures. It's somehow the way to define holomorphicity on the manifold. There could be many ways of doing it. Okay? And the way to decide whether two are equivalent or not is by putting the union and seeing if they are consistent with each other. Okay? So the standard example, which we won't do, but you can try it as an exercise, is the following. The standard example is the following. Take C2, okay? That's a nice complex manifold, of course. But that one is too boring. So let's do something to C2. Let's take two vectors, any two vectors. Even any two vectors in C. Okay? Of course, any two vectors such that they are not parallel to each other. Okay. Then, even these two vectors, you can define a lattice. Well, it's a little bit unfortunate that I drew it so close to, to the top of the blackboard. Well, we can do it going back. So, with this guy, you define a point here and a point here, and you can continue. And with this guy, you can put it here and so on. This guy, you can do it here, put it here. Okay, we have this line here, and so on. Okay, so you define this lattice. We call this the fundamental domain of the lattice. Okay, so this is a lattice. All these points define a lattice. Then what you do is to take C2 and you mod out by this lattice defined by W1 and W2. Meaning you identify any two points that are equivalent or that can be reached by just shifting by one element in the lattice. Okay? So you define that. What do we get if we do that? A torus. Okay? Well, probably this is not the standard way you see it. I mean, usually you think about the torus as something that you define when this guy is I and when this guy is some real number, right? So you think about the square lattice, and then you think about the torus, meaning that if you go here to this point, you come back here and so on, right? Okay. Sorry, in C. Thank you. Yeah, this is all in C. Yeah. The torus is a one complex dimensional object. Yeah. Now, the claim is that different choices of W1 and W2 of these two vectors give you different complex structures. Of course, this is, as we said, is a torus. Okay? So they give different complex structures. I don't know if I should say, yeah, maybe. Let me just say, give the same complex structure if these numbers, or these complex numbers, sorry, are related. So say somebody picks a choice, W2 prime and W1 prime, and somebody else chooses something different. Now the claim is that they give the same complex manifold, meaning that they have the same complex structure, and in other words, that this will be a complex manifold, the union of these two things, if and only if they are related by this relation, where A, B, C, and D is an element of SL to Z. What does this mean? It means Z means that A, B, C, and D, they belong to the integer numbers, and that the determinant of this matrix happens to be 1. Okay? So it's an exercise for you to show that this is indeed true. You can try to pick your favorite coordinates, some other coordinates, and show that if they are related by this relation, okay, then they define the same complex structure. All right. Any questions up to this point? This is all trivial. This is probably something that you all knew. Or it's too complicated, and it's something that looks completely, incredibly unfamiliar to all of you. Yeah, it would be nice to know which of the two.
Well, I didn't know any of this before, so.
So is this all trivial? Is this all familiar to you? Okay, if it's not familiar to you, is it understandable?
Okay.
Well, I can maybe ask a question. What does it exactly mean for a complex structure to be the same as another complex structure? So if you give me a complex structure, how can I test that it's the same or inequivalent to another one?
Yeah, so up to this point, I've defined a complex structure by giving you the atlas, right? So I have my atlas, you have yours, and I define the union of the two, okay? That union could be a disaster. It could be that the transition functions that I get are not compatible, meaning that they will not be holomorphic, right? If that happens, then the two atlases define different complex structures. So my definition, up to now, I only told you that the definition of a complex structure is that given by an atlas that satisfies the axioms that I told you, that the transition functions are holomorphic, okay? Now, somebody can come out with one, I can come out with another one. In other words, if I choose different W's, okay, you see that for any choice of W that is not degenerate, as a topological manifold, they are all the same object, right? So what is different is the complex structure that I'm attaching to the manifold, okay? So what's going to happen is that for choices that are not related by this relation, I will never be able to define the union of the two atlases and get something where the transition functions will be all nicely and holomorphic. And that means that the two define different complex structures. Oh, that reminds me that maybe I should tell you that people like to, well, just so that you see the picture, people like to define a parameter called tau, which is the ratio of these two numbers, okay? And people like to say that, well, since this group is generated by transformations of the form acting on tau is generated by transformations of this form, which in terms of the matrices are basically things of this form. These are examples of elements in SN to Z. Okay? You can check that. So if you apply these transformations on W's and compute the new tau, you will find these transformations. And that means that on the tau plane, each point you will think represents a different complex structure. But I just told you that if two taus are related by a transformation of this form, then they define the same complex structure. And therefore, people like to draw this picture that you may have seen. Minus a half and a half, one and minus one. And people would say that this is a fundamental domain of the inequivalent complex structures that you can attach to a torus. Meaning that any other tau that you choose, by applying consecutive transformations of this, you can always bring it to the fundamental domain. Okay? So any point outside of this plane, by applying relations of this sort, can be brought to a point inside this space. So this is called the fundamental domain.
Sorry,
but that's not very important for us.
What's plotted here?
Sorry?
What's plotted here?
The tau plane.
Okay.
This is the tau plane. So I'm trying to plot the space of all possible complex structures that you can put on a torus. Okay? Every possible thing that you can imagine is only contained in this. Every point here is a tau, which is a ratio of these two guys. And that defines for you a complex structure on the torus. Okay? The claim is that any point here, outside of this plane and here too, outside of this band, by applying transformations of this sort, you can bring it back to a point inside the band. That's why everything else is equivalent to some complex structure here inside. Okay? But this is very important in many topics in string theory, but nothing that we will do this week. Yeah?
I'm sorry, I walked in like halfway through this. So you're putting a lattice on the torus?
No, I'm defining the torus to be the complex plane modulo the lattice. So this is my complex plane, and I'm saying if you are somebody walking here and walk here, you appear here. Okay? So this is a standard way of defining a torus. Okay. Very good. Yes?
Is like, because we haven't defined any charts or anything like that.
On the torus?
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't, so that's your job. Yeah.
Okay, but like.
So that's your exercise. Take your torus, think about that as a fundamental domain here, define charts, and show that if you choose different W's, then you will find W's that are not related by these, you will find different complex structures, and if they are related by these, you will find the same complex structure, given the definition I gave at the beginning. Okay. Very good. So if you didn't understand this, don't worry. We're not going to use it. So just let's move on. Because now we're going to complexify. The tangent space. Okay? We have our manifold. We choose a point P. And we look at the tangent space. Any preferences for the basis of the tangent space? I don't know. We have 2m dimensions, 2m real dimensions. So it's natural to split them in half, right? It's natural to say, well, let's call half of the coordinates x's. And the other half, we're going to call them, guess what? Y's. Up to this point, this is completely silly, right? I'm just choosing to call my coordinates, half of them x's and the other half y's. Why? Well, because we're going to combine them nicely. Okay? So we're going to define complex coordinates . Okay. My choice of indices is very unfortunate because of the I here. But I hope you won't be confused. Yeah, maybe I should, at this point I should call it J here. Okay. Now J goes from 1 to M. But at some point I will also start using I's. So I hope that won't be confusing. Okay. This is a basis for our tangent space at the point P. How about basis for the dual tangent space? Well, we will use exactly the same notation. Okay, so that will be our dual space. And now we will complexify this guy by defining, so should I use J? Yeah. And okay, so that's our definition. And the definition is so that you might find it a little bit strange to have the z with a minus here and the z bar with a plus. But the definition is so that we can define these guys. Which looks more natural. Okay. Now an exercise for you is to show that this is the dual of this space, meaning that if we have DZJ you will have something like this. Okay. Is this all familiar to you? How to go the real version of this? So all you have to do is to use the real version. Okay? You use the real version, use the definitions, and show that this is true. And now the same thing should hold for these guys. And everything else must vanish. And the other one. Okay, very good. Up to this point, we haven't done anything interesting, really. We have just defined new objects, but we haven't done anything with them. So all the action starts right now when we define something that is called the ALMOS complex structure. And you will see why the name. And this guy, do I want to call it J? Yes. J is something that takes elements in the tangent space to the tangent space. Okay. So what kind of object this is? What kind of tensor? Even if forget about complex manifolds or anything, just as a real, in real differential geometry. What kind of object J is? Is what? Is which one? Yeah, but if it was just a one form, it would give you a real number, right? So it's a. It's a 1,1 form. It's a 1,1 tensor, right? So it has one index up and one index down, right? So it has to eat up one index of a vector, and it has to give you another vector, right? Okay, very good. So let me give you the definition. I'll tell you how JP acts on the basis, and then I'm done, right? If I tell you what it does on the basis, I'm completely done with that. Note that I'm putting P. What is P supposed to be? The point. I'm doing everything locally, right? So everything happens to at a given point. The tangent space, the dual, everything has been defined at a point. The interesting thing will happen when I try to put all the points together on the manifold, right? So I'll give you the definition. So if you take this guy, what you get is this guy, okay? And if you take this guy, what you get is this guy. Does it remind you of anything? It looks like multiplying by I. It looks like complex conjugation, right? So if you change the x by y and the y by minus x, so it looks like a complex conjugation. Not only that, note, of course, that if you apply JP twice, you get minus the identity. Okay? Now, this is called an almost complex structure because this can be done for any manifold locally at each point. You can do it. The problem is whether you can define this object globally in a consistent way so that on different patches you get your JP and you can go from one to the other using nice transition functions. So if we can define J globally, on M, then M is a complex manifold. And moreover, the complex structure is completely determined by J. Okay? So this is actually a theorem, which, needless to say, I'm not going to prove. What I'm going to do instead is to tell you why this JP is useful, why this almost complex structure is useful. Another exercise for you, but this one is actually extremely trivial, is to show that if you take this guy acting on Zi, you get back the same guy. Let's use J. This is actually I, okay? If you add with JP on the anti-holomorphic one, you get minus I. Okay? So now what can you do with this thing? This thing looks very interesting. You can use it to split up your tangent space into two vector spaces. Remember how we did it with the gamma matrix? We split the spinors into two different kinds of spinors using a projection operator, into positive and negative chirality. Well, JP looks like a projection operator. Okay? And it splits the tangent space. So what we can do with JP is to split the tangent space as the direct sum of holomorphic vectors and anti-holomorphic vectors. So we call these ones and these ones anti-holomorphic. Okay. Of course, here I'm talking about the complexified one, the one whose bases are given by these guys. Remember, that's what we did. We started with the real ones, and we defined these ones as bases of another vector space, which we call, or we should have called, the complexified tangent space. And now, using the almost complex structure, we can split it into two. Okay. So we're almost done with the basics of what we want to do, because now we have vectors. We understand the tangent space. What do we have to do? What's the next step? To understand differential forms, right? If we understand vectors, now we should just understand differential forms. Okay? So consider some differential form, just leaving on our real manifold, okay? So this is a differential form on M. Say is a P form, just to say something, okay? Now, there is a natural, there will be a natural separation of this space, which introduces something that is called a bidegree. By degree means that it has two indices. So we're going to split this into a set of objects that contain two indices. And what will be the two indices? Well, we're going to define the following. Imagine we build bases for these things so that the following happens. You take the form, it's a P form, so we have to put in P vectors, and we get a number. That's the definition of a P form, right? Now imagine the following. Imagine that, say, R of the V's are in Tm plus, and S of them belong to Tm minus. Okay? Of course, R plus S better be P, right? Now imagine that you find basis of this thing such that the following happens. This guy will vanish unless R of the vectors and in Tm plus and S of the vectors and in Tm minus. Okay? So it will vanish unless this happens. So if this guy is equal to 0 unless this happens and this happens, then we say that this omega belongs, of course it belongs here, but it belongs to a smaller vector space that sits inside that we're going to call R, S of m. Okay? Now the claim is that you can split this whole vector space as the direct sum of all these subspaces, okay, for all the values of R and S. And this is the by degree. So this looks very strange, but if we look at a local representation, that doesn't look that terrible. This guy will simply be something that has some bunch of indices, I1 up to IR, J1 up to JS, DZ I1 wedge, DZ I2 wedge, wedge DZ IR wedge, DZ bar, J1 wedge, DZ bar, JS. Okay? That's how it looks locally. Yes?
So the P form looks like this, and the tangent space is the space of the basis is D by D, Z thing.
Yes.
So what do you mean by Z belonging to it?
What do I mean by?
By the basis of omega belonging to
these are vectors, right? These are vectors. Remember, having a form is nothing but the dual space of the tangent space, right?
Yeah.
So if you have a P form, the P form eats P vectors and gives you a number.
Yeah.
You remember, right? So this is my P form, and it's eating up P vectors. The V stands for vectors. So the vectors are living in the tangent space. Now, with the almost complex structure, we split the tangent space into two spaces, into the direct sum of two spaces. Now, I declare that a form lives in this subspace of this big, big object if it vanishes unless, or the only time it gives you something non-zero is when the vectors that you put in, R of them are holomorphic and S of them are anti-holomorphic. Okay? Just the almost complex structure defined for you a natural splitting of the tangent space. Now, the natural splitting of the tangent space begs you to split the space of P forms into a direct sum of many objects. Okay? And this is how they look. Remember, from the exercise, now it's obvious that if you try to put here, act with this thing on many vectors, and they don't satisfy these conditions, you're going to get zero. Remember, from the first exercise that you have to do, right? Because this guy only gives you something non-zero when it acts on a holomorphic vector, and this guy something non-zero when it acts on an anti-holomorphic vector. Okay. So I hope you're familiar with the usual Derramme cohomology, right? If you have a real manifold, there is a cohomology that you can define, right, with the forms.
What's a cohomology?
What is a cohomology? Never mind, let's do a complex cohomology. Well, yeah. So what is the real version? The real version, of course, is using these guys because you don't have other guys. So what you do is to say, well, let me look in this space, let me look at the space of closed P forms. Okay? And this is usually called, so what's the notation for the, yeah, ZP of M, okay? Remember, this is the space of all P forms such that this is true, okay? And then you say, well, but this doesn't look quite interesting because, of course, if I have two guys that differ by an exact form where this eta is a P minus 1 form, really nothing that I do when I integrate or do interesting things will depend. I will get the same answer if I use this guy or if I use this guy. So even physically, well, this physically should look familiar, right? This looks like a gauge transformation. Mathematically, for mathematicians, these two is not a good idea to make a difference between these forms and this form. So what you usually do is to mod out this thing by the space of exact forms. Okay? So this space is called BP of M, and it's the space of all forms such that omega can be written like this. Okay? This is closed, and this is an exact form. So you define what is called the homology group. The cohomology group HP. So another unfortunate choice of notation. What is P here? It's the degree of the form. It's not the point where I'm looking at. In fact, the important thing about these things is that they are topological invariants, okay? So they actually don't even depend on how the manifold, you can deform it locally, and it doesn't depend on that, the structure of this group. So this group is ZP modulo BP, okay? Meaning, you define this equivalence relation. Any two closed forms that differ by an exact form define the same element in HP. Okay? So HP is made out of the classes of closed forms that differ by an exact form. Okay? Now all we want to do is a complex version of this. And that has a name, which actually I always fail to spell correctly, so I'm not going to try. It's called, and I'm sure I'm going to do a horrendous job pronouncing it, the Dolbach homology. It's just a complex version of this whole story. So how do we define the complex version of this? Well, it's not that complicated. All you have to notice is the following. Take this guy here and apply the exterior derivative to that object, right? After all, we know that to define cohomologies, we need to find closed forms or some analog of closed forms. So what we do is to take d omega, on this guy here. Well, what do we find? Well, we find that this is naturally given by derivative with respect to z, let me call it b of omega with all the indices dzb plus z bar b dzb with all the other guys here. Okay? This is this w here, this omega with all the indices. Okay? So this operator somehow mixes things up. So it's not a natural complex object. The D operator mixes things Because imagine that you take this little guy belonging to R, S. Now when you apply d omega, when you apply the exterior derivative, you get an object here, this one, and another one here. And this object looks like what? Like an element where? You're increasing R by 1, right? You're putting one more dz, and here you're putting a... You didn't see that, right? At one more dz bar. So the first object here belongs to omega r plus 1 s, and the second one to omega r s plus 1. So this is not a very natural object to work with. It's mixing up things. Well, why don't we just define a holomorphic version of the exterior derivative, like something that acts in this form and something that acts in this form? So that's what we're going to do. We're going to say that this is actually the definition of del W, and this is the definition of del bar W. Now, these are maps from R, S into omega R plus 1, S, and del bar is a map from R, omega R, S to omega R, S plus 1. That looks more like a complex thing, okay? Now, the Dolbach homology is the cohomology with respect to these operators. They turn out to be nilpotent as the exterior derivative is, okay? And that's why you can define a cohomology. So we will do exactly the same thing. We will just take R, S guys and define the space of closed R, S forms with respect to some operators, say del bar, okay? Which means this is an element of omega R, S such that it's closed, it's del bar closed, okay? Modulo exact forms with respect to del bar. Okay? Exactly the same thing that I did before. And now we're done here. So now I can define my cohomology group, my del bar cohomology group, to be R, S and R, S del bar. Yes?
What does the del look like? The del operator look like in component notation?
Well, we just did it. It was the thing that was in the bracket here.
Yeah, but with the J in there, with the complex structure, with the components of the complex structure.
No, we didn't have components. We define the definition acting on an object like this as something that takes the holomorphic derivative with respect to some coordinate zb or z. Yeah, the ZB, say, and introduces the DZB here.
Yeah,
that defines locally the structure completely.
Yeah, but well, what I meant to say then is in the original coordinates of the manifold, I guess.
Well, it's not a good idea to go back all the way there. I mean, it's like discovering that the hydrogen atom is nice in spherical coordinates and asking, oh, I want to see how it looks really in Cartesian coordinates.
Yeah, but
it's more or less the same question.
This J is some form. It's a 1,1 form living on the surface.
Yeah, we're going to go back to the almost complex structure again. Yeah. Actually, it's going to play a role right now.
Yeah. Did you also define the del net bar homology?
Sorry? Yeah, you can define the other one too. Yeah. So there is something interesting that people define, which is which are the Hodge numbers. These are numbers which are nothing but the dimension of these objects. Okay. It will turn out that these Hodge numbers will have a very important physical meaning.
What's the name of this del bar homology?
Yeah.
Delbert. It's easy to remember, Delbert. Is that just me?
Good. Okay. Now the next concept we need is a metric. Okay. So imagine we have a metric. Okay. So remember our metric, what does a metric do? Say at a point, it eats up two vectors and gives you a number. Right? Now we want a metric that plays nicely with the complex structure, or at least with the almost complex structure, right? So we want a metric actually that doesn't really care about the almost complex structure. So what do I mean by that? I mean that if you take these vectors, if you take the inner product of these two vectors, after you apply to them J, you don't really want to get a different answer. So these are the metrics that will play nicely with the almost complex structures. So if a metric satisfies this condition, it's called a Hermitian metric. Okay.
Does the Hermitian metric take the value of C or R?
Well, it's going to be complexified.
So it
takes values in C. So in fact, the definition, the definition starts with a definition of a metric on the real manifold. But then you complexify, meaning saying, imposing that it's linear in the action on a vector. So how do you define, if you know the metric on the real manifold, what happens if you act on something that looks like, say, X plus I, Y, C plus I, W. Well, you just pretend that this thing is completely linear, okay? So you expand it. So these are real vectors now, okay? Here I'm explaining what happens if you start with a real metric and want to define it as a complex metric. This is what you do. You just use the definition of real of any vectors that you like in your complex manifold, split them like this, and then use the definition that is completely linear, is bilinear, and then you get, well, what you get. So this is not the Hermitian metric. This is the definition of any metric, or the complexification of the metric. Okay, the metric is Hermitian if this happens. Okay.
Question.
Yes.
Is there any constraint on the metric? Can it be Euclidean or Lorentzian or?
Doesn't matter because we're complexifying the space.
Oh yeah, you're complexifying.
Yeah.
So the signature it does play a role.
No. Okay. So what do we do? Well, we define the components of the metric. Okay. This will be the notation. So people like to call this I bar J bar. And there will be mixed guys. You can imagine what they are, right? Let me write it down. And J, G, I bar. Well, this one you can imagine what it is. Now, this is for a generic, for a general metric, okay? The exercise, which is also very trivial, but I encourage you to do these exercises. They are all just plugging and see what happens, is to show that if the metric is Hermitian, you can use this to show that all these components are actually zero, and all the bar components also vanish. Okay? In other words, this implies that as a tensor, your metric is only something of this form. So the metric is starting to look very simple. This is one of the nice simplifications. So already the metric is doing something remarkable. But we're about to even specialize more to even a class of complex manifolds that do something even more special than being complex manifolds. Okay? But in order to do that, we have to define an important 1,1 form. So we want to define, we need a 1,1 form, so an element of 1,1. Okay? When I'm talking about 1,1 form, that's what I mean. Which is called the Keller form. And this is something that I can define on any complex manifold. So this is not the special condition that I want to impose. This is just on any complex manifold I can define this guy. And this guy is defined as follows. Imagine, yeah, this is a bad choice of notation. Yeah, but some people call it J, but we already use J for the almost complex structure. So, I don't know. Well, sorry. This is going to be a 1,1 form. We're just going to call it omega.
Why not K for L?
You will see there is a very important reason why not K. You will see why. So this guy takes two vectors. Okay, and it's defined as follows. I still, from the definition, it's not completely clear that this is going to be a two form, but we will see that it is. Just take the metric. You apply the almost complex structure to one of the guys, and do nothing to the other one. So this gives you a new vector. You take this vector, and apply the metric on both of them, and you get a number. So this is a two form, okay? Very good.
Any metric or a Hermitian metric?
At this point, any metric, but we want to do it on a complex manifold. So we're going to take G to be Hermitian. And that's precisely what is going to simplify. First of all, the next exercise for you is to show that if G is a Hermitian metric, then this guy, these two forms, or this object, yeah. I haven't told you that this, I haven't proven to you there is a form, and nor will I, but you will prove it. Because you will show that if G is Hermitian from the definition we had before, it's actually simple, but from the definition we had before, remember, these are general vectors. It has nothing to do with the real x and the real y. These are just names for general vectors. So you will show that this guy is anti-symmetric.
Are they holomorphic vectors?
They don't have to. At this point, they are completely generic vectors. I made a claim. I said that this guy was a 1,1 form. How can I tell that this guy is a 1,1 form? Do you remember the definition? It said a 2 form is a 1,1 form if and only if something happens. What is the thing that has to happen? So now I can define a form, okay, because it's anti-symmetric. So what I'm sure is that this omega guy is a 2 form. In the real sense. But how do I know that it's in the 1,1 sector?
If you will use two holomorphic vectors in this range.
Exactly. So that's the next exercise, is to show that if you plug in two holomorphic vectors, you get zero. Likewise, if you plug in two anti-holomorphic vectors, you get zero. That's your exercise. Remember, that was the definition of a 1,1 form. Okay? Having done that, we can now write what this scalar form is. So, just in terms of the metrics, it turns out to be very simple. And it plays nicely with the fact that the only non-zero component of the metric was the ij bar. Okay, so this is our Keller form. Now the Keller form is very important for general complex manifolds. And the reason is the following. It's with this guy that you define integration on the complex manifold. Remember, to define an integration on a complex on any manifold, you need to define, you have to find a nowhere vanishing top form, right? A form of maximal degree on the manifold. So we have to find a 2m form, real 2m form, or an m form that is nowhere vanishing. Well, there is a theorem, which is actually not difficult to prove, that tells you that if you take omega m times, okay, you take the wedge product m times of this guy, you produce the form that you want, okay? Well, I should leave it with this. I should leave it with a 2m form in the real sense. So this is clearly a 2m form in the real sense, because omega is already a 2 form. M times is a 2m form. And the theorem is that this guy is nowhere vanishing, and therefore defines a volume element. So that's very useful if you want to do integrations. But that's not what we want to do. What we want to do is to find a very special class of these manifolds. And the special class is just obtained by imposing a condition on the Keller form. And this is called Keller manifolds. Okay? So up to now, everything that we did here was true for any complex manifold. But general complex manifolds are complicated. We want complex manifolds with special properties. And you will see why we didn't call it K very soon. So a Keller manifold is, so M is Keller if the Keller form is a closed form. That's the definition. Yeah, too much excitement just for that. Oh yeah, we're gonna do something spectacular. This is all the top. Well, but you will see why it's spectacular. The reason is that locally, if you compute this thing, remember what this is. D is just the sum of these two operators, del and del bar, acting on omega. But omega was that object there. So gi, j, okay? So saying that this is zero imposes a condition that this guy acting on this and this guy acting on this will have to be related. So I don't want to mess up the indices. So let me tell you what the relation is. So it imposes a very non-trivial condition on the metric. Okay? This must be true for this to be zero locally. But what does it look like? Remember, when you have a function and you show that the derivative with respect to something happened to be equal to the derivative with respect to something else. So imagine that you have a vector, okay, say in two dimensions. And you show that the derivative with respect to y of x happens to be equal to the derivative of x with respect to y. So these are usually conditions for what?
Can separate the equations.
Well, they are also conditions for the existence of, for this guy to actually be the gradient of a function, right? A vector field that satisfies this condition is precisely one for which you can define it as a gradient of a function. The reason is that if you have del x dy happens to be y dx, what it's telling you is that v could actually be the gradient of a function, right? Because this means, all this means is that dx is del x phi and dy is del y phi, which trivializes this constraint, right? The same thing happens here. And now this function is actually called capital K. That's the reason we didn't that's the reason we didn't call omega K. So this means that our metric, the whole metric, this is really, really incredible. The whole metric, so all the structure in our manifold, is determined by a single function. And you just apply derivative to it. So k is just a function. I only give you a function, and I define the whole metric on the manifold. K